If you look at some of the numbers from IC3 reports, not just ransomware, from pig butchering, romance scams, to fake investments, to theft, you know, email compromise, it's $20, $30 billion a year that Americans are losing, and that's growing. But the attention, the judicial process and speed in which we have to be able to do anything about it, we have a long way to go.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another Identity Breach Confidential edition of the HIP Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Duby, with my co-host, Jeff Wickman, Semperis Director of Incident Response, also known as The Negotiator, and a veteran in digital forensics and ransomware negotiation. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how's it going?
Today, we're going to talk about the inside details of what happened in a cybercrime breach incident. These details are usually very murky, not the least because the parties involved are either legally or by policy unwilling to talk about it. This includes whether or not to pay ransom. We could have an entire identity breach episode just debating that. What's talked about even less is what goes on if the organization decides to pay. What happens after that decision is made? And what happens afterwards in relation to monitoring the payment, blockchain forensics, coordination with law enforcement and crypto investigation firms, all the way through to crypto seizures? Our guest today is someone intimately familiar with the whole process. Mark Jason Grenz is president of ChainTrax, which has been providing cutting-edge financial, technological, and consulting services for the payments and incident response industry for the last 12 years. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a very interesting topic to be sure, and certainly one that is not discussed very much. But I'm curious, you know, you and Jeff have a connection in your careers. How do you two know each other?
It was back at the Uni42 days.
Correct.
When we were doing some work for providing compliance, sanctions, due diligence when their clients were ready to make payments. We were one of their preferred vendors that they brought on during his time at the Uni42 group.
Mark, it is great seeing you again. It has been a long time since we've chatted ransom payments. Thankfully, I don't do that as much anymore. Taking a step back before we get to the ransom payments, you know, handling ransomware incidents is obviously important. What I think I know, but what, from your opinion, what's the reason that victims actually end up making the payment to the threat actor?
Sure. Statistically speaking, less than 20% of all cases that are hit by ransomware and those that communicate with the threat actor actually end up making a payment. The various reasons are, I think, you know, those familiar with incident response or ransomware incidents, it's a double extortion situation where a victim has been encrypted and their data, their production database has been encrypted and they're offline. And the other extortion element is when there's proof that data has been stolen. So those two components is kind of drive a decision on whether or not a payment is going to be made by all the stakeholders involved, stakeholders being the cyber insurance company, the company victim themselves, and the law firm that has brought on, you know, to help come up with a consensus that it makes sense to make a payment. So some of the core reasons would be if it's deemed that during an encrypted event that their backup systems are not strong enough or as quality as they thought they were to be able to get back online, or the cost of restoration to boot back up without paying or getting their production database back up and run it is far more expensive than what the threat actor is offering to be able to purchase it. So the first usual statement comes with a client who's not experienced with this during a ransomware event is how do we even trust these groups? As Jeff, you know, they're very reputable groups. They are in the business to make money. They're in the business to get paid. So there is that sort of quote unquote honor among thieves in the event when they're ready to make a payment. The industry confirms and validates that, you know, they are majority speaking, you know, good on their promises when a payment is made. So paying for a decryptor to speedy recovery is one way. And then what's becoming more popular and more also more complicated is we're seeing less encryption payments, and we're seeing more payments that are associated with data exfiltration. So that's when the threat actor comes in and does a crash and grab, steals all the data, and then says, hey, look, I'm going to hold you hostage. So reason for paying would be that it could be a reputational reason where certain data that gets out that they don't want to hurt the reputation. Another instance is protecting clients. The clients that could be harmed as a result of this and loss of customers if this data is released could be a reason to make a payment. And then also PII and PHI, that's related with healthcare, financial services especially, and even law firms who have really sensitive PII information that they don't want to get out because of repercussions above and beyond, you know, even legal disclosures, class action lawsuits that happen regardless if they're paid or not. So they kind of factor that all in to make a determination that a payment is going to be made. But it usually comes near the end where it's a last resort. It's typically when you have professionals involved, as Jeff knows, that's a last resort. They try to exhaust all other options before a payment is made.
20%, yeah, absolutely.
That's a lower amount than I thought.
Yeah, actually, I'm surprised. But granted, most of the cases that I did when I was with Unit 42, I would say 90% of them ended up in payment, but maybe they just never got even to our, you know, step of the woods for trying to determine if they needed a payment. And of course, that was years ago. So you touched on something that I want to hone in on. So we're talking to attackers. We're talking to criminals. How do you, and I know we track specific groups on how trustworthy they are. How often do you see an attacker delivering all of their promises, and how, and the most important piece is, how can the industry be certain that they are not keeping the data for coming back a second time?
That is, you know, it's a really good question, because it's obviously there's no silver bullet, and regardless of what they say, they're still criminals. Even if you pay them, they'll show you a video. Here's the file and folder before and after, and we'll do a screenshot, and they'll send you like an MP3 clip or a video clip of that, doing that over like 20 seconds, or just show you a couple of screenshots before and after. So it really becomes honor among thieves. You know, as just you're well aware, there are security researchers that are constantly digging on the dark web, you know, exfiltrating these rooms, having fake personas that are getting in Telegram chats, they're getting in other dark web chat rooms, and who are masking themselves like an affiliate of these ransomware groups to get intelligence. There's a whole industry around that. And they're well aware of that as well. And I think once they decide that we are not going to keep our promises, the general consensus is that it'll break loose within the industry, knowing that they even have insiders that are leaking information to, you know, the good guys like us, that eventually they're going to stop paying. You look at the typical leak sites, you look at the typical sites that are selling stolen data, and to see that they're buying packages, then you stop seeing payments will dramatically drop. Where we're seeing a risk of either re-extortion or threat actors not being good in their promise are those that are in the unknown game. So after Black Hat went offline and Lockbit got sanctioned and they shut down, you saw a lot of affiliates say, you know, I'm not gonna hook up with another affiliate. I'm gonna go and try it on my own. As you know, there's so much leaked code and malware out there. Lockbit's got multiple versions out there, as well as Black Hat and other variants toolkits that are leaked are using to say, I'm just gonna go and attack myself. They're not part of a playbook. So typically, when we see that, we usually throw flags on that to, you know, state that there's a much higher risk, because this is not a well-known affiliate, it's not a well-known group, we don't know. We try to look for their cadence in communications and how they operate, how do they respond to the questions, just to get a vibe if they are experienced or not. And if we feel like they're not following protocol that we're used to, we'll then usually raise our hand and say, okay, this is high risk. We can't, you know, we think there's a higher risk of re-extortion or them not being the promise.
So that's you touched on something that has been much on my mind, or I've been very curious about, and you have got a great word for it, re-extortion. I hadn't heard that, but right. What is the reassurance, and I use that in quotes, that they're not going to go, oops, we forgot to do this and we need some continuing income. So you go ahead and pay us, you know, on a yearly basis. Otherwise we'll reveal it. Yeah. Okay. We confess we're keeping it. But in order to us not reveal it, you have to pay us on a regular basis. Have you encountered that much? Is that more the rogue
all of
actors?
More of the exception than the rule. We do see majority of cases. There are tools out there to monitor the dark web that you can hook into to look at and do keyword searches with certain platforms that we're privy to, you know, amongst our own tooling to see that we're good on the promise. Is it guaranteed? No. There's obviously other places that they could do that are offline that are not able for us to search on the dark web. But, you know, I mean, typically they do hold their promise, especially the well-known groups who are doing this on a regular basis and will continue to do so. They kind of have a creed within all of those members of their organization to not leak the data.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was pretty rare where we had a re-extortion. I did see it a couple of times, but those were usually, like you said, they were new groups, not very trusted in the industry. And sometimes it was accidental. I had one case where they actually sent the wrong data to the client. So we had to reach out to another client and say, hey, you had a ransomware event recently. Did you pay? And they were like, yeah, they destroyed the data. It's like, sorry. Part of my favorite so far in this discussion is something that I don't know if the general populace knows. When, you know, an organization is looking at making a payment, it is not just a single person. It is not just the board. There are a number of people making the decision whether or not to make the payment. Like Mark said, the insurance industry, the legal firm that brought them in, the ransomware, you know, team that is responding. There's a group of people helping. My personal view on it is never pay. However, that's completely separate from what a business risks are during something like that. And, you know, I think, I don't want to say organizations need to have a little slack cut. Sometimes I think they get beaten up for making a payment. Usually there's a reason they don't just make payments to make payments. So stepping forward in the incident response cycle and the, you know, ransomware payment cycle, I'm with Unit 42. I reach out to Mark and I say, hey, we've got a ransom payment. Where do you start? Where do you come in? Obviously, I've contacted you. What are the things that you're looking for? How do you validate? Obviously, you've got a database of information on the attackers.
Yeah.
What's your process?
I think it's interesting. I'm going to take a step back here.
Yeah.
We got in this industry in 2017. One of our advisory board members, was formerly senior up with the FBI in cyber and international affairs, came to me and said, you guys need to get in the ransomware business. And at the time I said, what is ransomware? That was from a previous business we had with compliance and AML in cash to cryptocurrency services. And he said, you guys have really strong compliance and have a platform and the infrastructure to set up to support it. We're having trouble making smooth payments in here. So the interesting thing is, the reason I'm bringing that up is that there is no book, there is no rule, regulation, anything that says, here's exactly how you need to do it. In order to comply from all Bank Secrecy Act and anti-money laundering and sanctions regimes, there was no book that was out there that says, here's how you need to do it. So we had to use kind of, they call it a risk-based approach to say, what can we do to the depths? How can we iterate and grow upon this to de-risk this payment as much as possible? Because there's no such thing as a guaranteed. And anybody says that to you is selling you, a fake, a false bag of goods, because the amount of due diligence that needs to really go into it, is nearly impossible. Because the reality is, we're dealing with threat actors. The super majority of them are overseas. They're not in the United States or in North America for that matter. They're using VPNs. They're rerouting IP addresses that are coming, even their command and control through IPs are not coming from where it is. So you really have a lot of noise from the IOCs are being collected in TTPs. So it's like, okay, what can we go on? What certainties are there, right? So the certainties you have are the sanctions databases. That's OFAC and then all the rest of the world. You know, at this point, we're up to, I think, close to 50 different lists around the world and growing that we'll look at for each element. Okay, so we can look at IP addresses, right? What IP shows what is coming in, what is noise, what's real, to at least take that, because it's real data we can look at, right? What open source intelligence is out there on the variant group, right? We get ransom notes and we get, you know, at times the comms thread to see the cadence and see the communication, say, yeah, this is Akira, this is Killen, right? This is Ransom House, whoever, Dragon Force. This is predictable. We also look at our proprietary database. In the beginning, we didn't have a proprietary database, right? But now we've, you know, been party to over 4,000 different incidents. We look. Additionally, we use now collaboration. We communicate regularly with all the incident response firms, Palo Alto being one of those, amongst all the ones out there, you know, to see things that may be of concerning that we reach out to, just to see if there's a common thread, common themes that they're seeing. Because right now we have sanctioned countries such as North Korea, Syria, Iran, and then the Russian Federation, where meaning that a group, so Russia technically is not sanctioned, but funding anything that supports the war or the government is a sanctioned event. So it's a little more gray. So what can we do to prove that none of it is supporting any of those three or on the list, right? We also dig on the dark web. We use different tools to look up any connections, any conversations and chats. We follow that and we get it audited. We are required by law to get audited every year by a reputable consultant who understands the concept of sanctions and AML to see what we're doing is what we're supposed to, and then validate that we're doing it in every case. It becomes very heavy and very taxing at this point, because the reality is, you know, OFAC will never come to you and say, this is exactly what you need to follow. They're never going to tell you that. We've communicated with them, and they'll usually give you a general blanket response. You know, talk to your lawyer, click in this link and read our website, you know, on how to follow. And that's, you know, yeah. They keep it a little more interpretive to follow that approach. But all I can say is that the level of due diligence, level of transparency, I think is key with the entire industry. Taking an approach that is, you know, before we put a variant on the blacklist or even a concerning variant we put on the whitelist to approve, we don't do that in a vacuum. We take a very collaborative approach to each and every variant because, again, there is no black and white do it. It's the best way to, you know, do it from a standpoint of growing the industry and trying to do it from the risky, you know, the least amount of risk as possible.
Right on. That makes sense. So there's no one entity that controls what the sanctions are. Obviously there's OFAC for the United States, but is there other countries that if you're getting involved with, do you have to pay attention to that? Like company in France?
What's interesting right now is there's a crypto exchange called Huobi that has been sanctioned by the UK, but only the UK, right? So this is sort of a new venture for seeing, okay, if there is a threat actor who is getting paid and then using that exchange to launder money, is that a sanctionable offense if we're a payer registered in the United States, we're domiciled in the United States, and the client is in the United States. Are we violating a UK sanction by doing that, right? So those are interesting sort of rhetorical questions that we need to think about, you know, that we take back. You know, is it if it's a client in the UK and the variant is washing through that, is that a sanctionable event, right? The answer is probably likely yes, but these are things that we take in. Part of the reason we expanded probably about 7 years ago into global sanctions is, you know, given a lot of the work and capital that supports this industry is cyber insurance companies. Cyber insurance companies, the larger ones, are rarely just domiciled in the United States. They are global. You know, when you think about the top 10, they have entities in countries all over the world, and their compliance and legal teams, you know, take a global approach, right? So they like to see that we've done our due diligence on all the different regimes. Mind you, the supermajority of the Venn diagram is overlapped in terms of the different ransomware threat actor groups that are sanctioned, the wallet addresses that are sanctioned, and the countries that are sanctioned, especially in Europe, UK, Australia, even APAC and the North America, a lot of overlap. But we still go through our due diligence every case as if it's a global case regardless.
Has to be. So on that, I'm Joe, you know, CEO of some company, and my company gets hit. It's important that we, or my organization, works with attorneys and firms to make a payment. What happens if they don't and they risk that on their own?
We've seen that in several cases where within a policy, especially, you know, we'll start with those that are insurance backed, because those are the ones we have most familiar with, is that we've received calls from insurance companies that says, hey, one of my insured decided to make a payment on their own. They probably opened up a Coinbase or Kraken account, funded it, sent out a withdrawal, paid the threat actor and whatnot, and then submitted a claim. Within their policy, in a lot of situations, they said, you need to use approved vendors. You need to do full, you know, due diligence from a sanction standpoint for abiding by OFAC. And the client, the insurer will be like, what's OFAC? So they're not going to do the work. They'll come to us and say, can you run a post facto, you know, a full on report to deem if this was a sanctioned payment or not? The answer is always going to be no, we don't do that. We do the due diligence for ourselves at the time and could do our best to do our due diligence to see if it's a sanctioned risk or not at the time. Post facto has all sorts of risks associated with it, and that is not something that we intend on doing. So the risk is they're going to lose their claim. They're not going to get reimbursed for that payment. Also, it's a strict liability with OFAC regime himself. They make a payment and it gets reported and turns out that they made a payment to a sanctioned entity. You know, the U.S. Treasury, you know, and either some other enforcement agency come back to that company and said, hey, what due diligence did you do to prove this wasn't an entity in North Korea? We found out it was, and we see that you paid it. Show us your due diligence. And they're going to say, I can't show you anything. So they put themselves at risk when they do that, because OFAC violations are not just to financial service companies. OFAC violations can happen to anybody who is not following the rules, regardless if you're in the flow and has a compliance program that's audited like us and they don't. Why, you know, so
this is when compliance runs headlong into people running around with their hair on fire that want to get things done as quickly as possible. Yeah. And they don't want to follow all the process.
Yeah. And you know, and they're probably not making high risk international payments on a regular basis, right? Sure. You know, they don't have to think about it, that they have a contractor or they're a supplier that they're sending payments to that's coming from the Middle East. You know, they want to make sure they're not paying Iran, which is currently on the sanction list. So they don't do that regularly, and they have to come to somebody when their hair is on fire. The last thing they want to think about is a sanction risk. That's where it helps when you have vendors who are experienced in financial services to come in and do the right thing, who are fully licensed from a federal and a state standpoint and are audited on a regular basis to say, okay, I feel safer knowing that I have a vendor that is reputable, that's been doing this for a while and is checking all the right boxes.
Yeah. And in reality, risk of paying a such sanctioned entity, that's jail time, isn't it? Basically shutting down a company.
Yeah. I mean, if there's usually that's more if it's a pattern of abuse.
Oh, okay.
Criminal violation. Again, I can't speak for OFAC, you know, or work there, nor been an attorney studying it, but, you know, there could be sanctions, there could be, you know, financial, you know, fees, whatever, loss and impact as a result of doing that. Of not knowing. And, you know, it happens. How many times do you think there's been a ransomware payment that's been made that has gone unreported And they've decided their own IT team is going to negotiate and handle the restoration themselves and open up a Coinbase account, and do a withdrawal. So I'm sure it's happened many times that we don't know.
Oh, it has. I had one. I don't know. I thought I brought it to you, and it's back in the day. I still get a chuckle about it. This guy had a car dealership, a small car dealership, got hit by ransomware. He was tech savvy. He had a Ethereum account. So he contacted the attackers and paid them from his Ethereum account. The attackers, they looked and they were like, "You still have 11 Ethereum in there. Pay us more." He had money. So they upped the game. And then he came to us and asked us for help. And it was like, "I don't know what to tell you. They know what you have." But it is what it is, and it's unfortunate. But you need to rely on experts when you're dealing with something like a ransomware attack, especially a crypto payment for a ransomware. So what happens after payments? What are we as an industry doing to try to hunt them down? Obviously, we don't want to give away too much, but I'm sure the attackers know some of the tricks we're doing.
So something we've been doing early on, and this was part of a compliance program, as after the payment is made, we have requirements to follow the payment, minimum 30, 60, 90 day SLA, and have a compliance analyst use tools like TRM Labs, Elliptic, Chainalysis, and such that have attribution on the blockchain to try to follow the breadcrumb trail to see the common patterns where the different groups are laundering, washing their funds for different exchanges around the world, and also look for attribution, potentially for sanction violations. If they're using sanctioned exchange, like Garantax, for example, out of Iran is a sanctioned exchange, amongst others, to be able to report on that with law enforcement and give them intelligence to make decisions. The good benefit about being under the Bank Secrecy Act and being fully licensed is that we have the ability to communicate with law enforcement much quicker and more seamlessly in a safe way under the BSA than others do. So we've been doing that for a long time, providing a lot of intelligence that at times law enforcement working with OFAC and U.S. Treasury could eventually have a group get sanctioned because of some of the things that they're doing and how they're laundering money, using that as part of the attribution amongst other intelligence that they're probably getting. So we've been doing that for a long time now, and regularly provided that intelligence to our government. What we came to realize is there are, with the expansion of the crypto crime investigation industry, with more of an attention from our government, sort of, I'll get that in a moment, on being able to track down these criminals and their money to be able to freeze and seize and return these victims, we realized where we were sitting is in a really good spot. So why not figure out ways to track and hunt down these threat actors on a regular basis, keep providing that intelligence, and work to draw more attention and put pressure on these exchanges around the world that are known places where threat actors wash their money. And we have internal expertise who know how to do blockchain tracing. We're well-trained and well-versed for many years, who can follow the breadcrumb trail using these tools and have near 100% certainty that this is where the funds are going. We will go out and reach in conjunction with law enforcement and other investigation groups, put pressurizing exchanges in hopes that they freeze and return these funds back to the victim. So we've been doing that for less than a year now. We've learned a lot. We learned that the industry as a whole, the ecosystem of law enforcement needs a lot more resources. Crypto crime, if you look at some of the numbers from IC3 reports, not just ransomware, from pig butchering, romance scams, to fake investments, to theft, email compromise, Coinbase account drains, it's $20, $30 billion a year that US, Americans are losing, and that's growing. But the attention, the judicial process and speed in which we have to be able to do anything about it, we have a long way to go. I know recently the White House enacted a crypto task force to go after all the fraudsters out in the Southeast Asia, where these massive scam centers are, where they're literally imprisoning, enslaving people to put in these centers with barbed wire to live and stay there and force them to scam Americans in any possible way that they can. It's a very well orchestrated enterprise that is, has been well known now for the last couple of years and is not slowing down anytime soon. That puts us at risk. And without a strong investigation capabilities to hunt them down, to seize the assets, it's not going to slow down. So we're on a mission to continuously support, figure out ways to seize that, those assets. We have a long way to go, but we think we're on the right track for that.
Nice. It's good to hear that, you know, there's progress being made. Granted, I would still say we're just coming out of infancy in crypto. And the ability to, like you said, follow the chain and hopefully get some of that money back. Hopefully in the near future, we'll get a little bit further along the lines and, you know, make a dent in the ransomware payment industry itself. What's next? What do you think and what do you see on the horizon then?
I think it's going to be continued collaboration with the industry. You know, we can't, to be able to take down these actors and hit it where it hurts most, and that's in their pocketbooks, it's going to take a communal effort. So I think what's next for us to be able to effectuate that mission is reaching out continuously to the insurance companies, to the law firms that support this space, and the DFIR community and other vendors that are doing this, you know, and friendly competitors, to be able to share data, share intelligence on a regular basis. So I think continue that. There's a group that was started 5-6 years ago. It's a public-private summit. It's called IVAN, the Illicit Virtual Asset Network. It's private sector and public. There's law enforcement, DEA, FBI, Secret Service, and it's all focused on providing collaboration on a regular basis to combat crypto crime. How do we increase presence? And they use that as also an arm to, you know, effectuate policy in DC. We are one of the invited members and a regular contributor to that group to provide our knowledge within the space that we know to, again, the whole goal is to try to, you know, hit them where it hurts, and that's in their crypto pocketbooks.
Absolutely. You know, it's fascinating to me within this discussion is several things. One is how, if I want to call it the industry or not, has grown up on both sides.
Yeah.
You know, as the threat actors have become much more professional, and the recovery process and payment process has become much more organized. Against that is the fact that, you know, law enforcement goes after these groups, and they're broken apart, and they all spring up separately again and reform themselves, which seems like an endless task. But yeah, what you brought up is most interesting is that, yeah, but they all use crypto. So there is a common thread, and the work that you say is being done and is encouraging to hear, that sounds really promising.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we have a long road ahead of us. You know, looking at the industry and what we're doing, trying to be a trailblazer in going after them, we do still see other vendors out there who are making payments that are not following all the compliance rules, not fully licensed, not getting audited, not having an independent BSA officer. And when you have the infrastructure in place, and we call it bank-grade compliance, not the speed of bank. I think when you hear legacy bank, you think slow, you think clunky. We think compliance, a very conservative, traditional approach of due diligence and AML, which is very strong on the bank standpoint. We see a lot of providers not following those rules. And what ends up happening is you have limited and less than the opportunity for collaboration, less than the opportunity for that good quality data to get in the right hands to potentially find ways to find more attribution where the threat actors are watching, and then ultimately, you know, freezing, seizing, and return those funds to victims, you know, can be lessened, you know, when others are not following the rules.
Let me throw one last question at you that you just made me think of. Where would an organization go to find those most legitimate providers? You know, they find themselves in the situation, it's like, do they talk to the government?
There's no black and white way of doing it. What we look at is following the letters of the law. The letters of the law is what's dictated by, you know, the U.S. Treasury under FinCEN as a money services business, and following the Bank Secrecy Act and the four pillars of being a money service business. And then also reaching out to the state's Department of Financial Services. There are 10 states that require a money transmission license. There are 11. California is going to be requiring it, amongst a few others. So it's usually going out, because that's all public information. You figure out what states are requiring licensing, and are they licensed in the state? So if you go to the state of Washington today, for instance, and you can see on our website, should be a link at the bottom as well, you'll see all the states that were required to license. If a company in Seattle, Washington, for instance, gets hit by ransomware, they want to make a payment. If they use a vendor that is not licensed in the state of Washington, they are violating the law under statute of their DFS. And I think Georgia, Florida, Iowa, Connecticut, Ohio, just the ones that are, I know, off the top of my head. And those are going to continue to grow. I think a lot of it is because they want to make sure groups are following the right way, right? There's only so much the U.S. government can do overseeing vendors, but now the states are coming in because they realize how crypto is powerful, how much money gets moved on the blockchain, and they want some level of transparency. So we understand why they want you to get licensed, so they can know who are the companies, their constituents that are within this, you know, that are being impacted and affected. What can they do to help improve,
right?
You know, yeah. And limit the damage, and sometimes collaboration and data through licensing is the optimal way.
Well, yeah, I'm sure people watching this are thinking, oh gosh, one more thing that I have to factor into my crisis management incident response plan. Even though we don't want to pay ransom, you'd be foolhardy to think that it's beyond all possibility. And so this is something that you should be looking into as part of your planning, just in
case. Yeah. So shameless plug, Sean, we do have a proactive retained offering, and we do work with several clients to help plug in that gap to provide assurance, you know, especially on the payments and the compliant payment side of things.
Well, that's good to know. Good to know.
And it's important for organizations to have that, because the last thing, from my experience, when I was with Unit 42 and even here at Simperis, the last thing you want to do is negotiate contracts while you're in the middle of a crisis. Get it out of the way, get it taken care of, so that if the worst case happens, you're moving along a little bit quicker than...
I can't tell you how many times we've seen, especially with the organizations that want to follow, called SOC 2 Type 2 attestation, their level of vendor due diligence comes in, really slows things down. And sometimes that can cost a lot of money, delayed by the time that they approve a new vendor off the bat. For our retained clients, we enable much more flexibility on that to get onboarded even before an incident happens. They don't worry about that during the incident. Knock on wood, none of our retained clients have ever been hit by ransomware, but you know, they're prepared.
Right.
And that's the key, being prepared.
Well, thanks, Mark. This has been a fascinating conversation. And of course, thanks, Jeff, for asking all these great questions. This definitely has increased my knowledge of what's going on behind the scenes, and hopefully as well to everybody that's watching this. Jeff has heard me say before, you know, it's my thinking is nobody wants to get involved in a situation like this, but everybody wants to learn as much as they can about what to do if it does happen. So you're doing a public service. So
good. Absolutely. Thanks, Sean.
You bet. Right. And thanks, everybody. Thanks for watching the HIP Podcast, and we will see you next time. Thanks so much for listening to the HIP Podcast, brought to you by Semperis, the leader in identity resilience. If you found this conversation valuable, subscribe to the show on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, so you never miss an episode. And if you have a minute,
please give us a rating or leave us a review, as that really helps other listeners find the show. You can find past episodes and more information at hipconf.com/podcasts. I'm Sean Doobie. Stay secure, and I'll see you in the next one.